And now the great moment has arrived. And it's with a great deal of joy that I introduce what I think is one of the great shepherds of the flock of Alcoholics Anonymous, Chuck C. Laguna Beach.
I am the great shepherd of this flock. But I mean, this is a hell of a flock, too, isn't it? I'm the cause of the power shortage this afternoon. It came just a little too early. I thought I was going to get to duck all of this. That's a lie. I still lie a lot. I want to first thank your committee for giving me this privilege. I really am here to tell you that I love this program and I love its people. There's nothing that I would prefer doing than to spend a day or two with people like you. I've been here now because of people like you, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a loving God whom I found after finding you people. It's been unnecessary for me to take a drink or sedate your tranquilizing pill. 37 years plus. That's quite a while, but it's not long enough. I've had two lives, but I've lived long enough to have two. Here I am in the middle of my 81st year right now. My first 43 years, I never made a mistake. I was the manager of my life. I was the captain of my soul. Everything that turned out right, I took the credit for it. And everything that turned out wrong was your fault. I always had some place to point the finger. And I got to 43 years old. And something happened. I got drunk. But I didn't know it. I remember the Friday before Christmas, 1945. I remember that. The next thing I remember was the 18th of January, 1946. Now, I don't see how that's possible. Really, I don't. Because that's 28 days. And I never heard of anybody having a blackout that lasted 28 days. But that one did. And I came to the 18th of January, 1946, with nothing between me and me. Every I want and every excuse was burned out. And I knew without knowing why that I'd lost the battle of life. It was the first time in my life that I had ever admitted defeat. Now, don't think I'm trying to tell you that I'd won all my battles up until then. I didn't. But I never admitted defeat once in my first 43 years. I had an older brother, 3 years and a half older than I and 3 years and a half stronger. We had one fight that lasted 20 years on the installment plan. He could always whip me, and he did. But he could never make me admit it. I left home at 20 thinking I could whip him. So I didn't learn very fast. And I didn't learn very fast with that bottle either. But I don't believe I could have gotten here any other way. I don't think I could have gotten here any other way at all. Because I think that had I had to consciously surrender the first time, I'd have died without coming. I could not admit defeat, and never did, until my last go around with the bottle. So I don't have any regrets. I'm one who thanks God for all the calamities that ever happened in my life and all the drinks that I ever took. I thank God, because it took them all to get me here. And I'm grateful for the whole batch and caboodle. I said that I'd had two lives, and that's true. I was the master of ceremonies and star of the show for 43 years. And I come to and the show's over. And fortunately, I knew it. I didn't know why, but I knew that I'd lost the battle of life. I knew nothing about alcoholism. I knew an awful lot about being drunk, about DTs, about convulsions, about the inside of jails, but I didn't know anything about alcoholism at all. I came to with one remaining chore to perform before I died. I knew I was going to die and was all right. But I didn't want to die with a record. I never reached the point in my entire drinking career that I didn't love my wife and my kids. On many occasions, when I was drinking, I tried to sell myself the idea that I didn't love them. Because loving them gave them the right to hurt me. And I tried my best to talk myself out of the fact that I even loved them. But I never made it. And that morning that I came to, I loved my wife and my kids. And I knew that I had practically killed him. So I had one piece of business unfinished, and that was to rub out as much of the record as I could before I died. And in thinking about that, I knew that I couldn't rub out a record drinking. And I didn't know how not to drink right now. I didn't know how. And so I was looking at that dealie. How am I going to not drink right now? And I remembered, well, it was the second miracle that happened that morning. The first one was that I came to breathing in and out. And that was sort of a miracle. And the second one was that I remembered Jack Alexander's article. Mrs. C. had found it, had read it, and had left it open on the left arm of the chair I sit in right now, hoping that when I came in, if I came in, I'd read it. And evidently I did. But I hadn't remembered one thing about it for 5 years. This was 46, and that came out in 41. And I remembered that I'd read that article. And I remembered only two things about it. That drunks helped drunks and didn't drink. And they called it Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said to myself that morning, if I ever live to get out of this bed, I'll find AA. And immediately, the curtain dropped. My little period of sanity was over. And I was sick to death and drunk and insane. And I had a lot of dying to do. But from the moment of commitment until right now, I've never had one conscious desire for a drink or a sedating or tranquilizing pill. Now, my first group, after I found you people, was the Beverly Hills group. And every time I ever said that I hadn't had a conscious desire for a drink since that period, since that moment, when I made my commitment to myself, if I ever live to get out of this bed, I'll find AA. Every time I said that in the Beverly Hills group, 90% of them hit the floor. And in unison, they said to me, "You're a goddamn liar." That's what they said. And they always did say it. Because they were having a little trouble not drinking. We call it white knuckle sobriety. I never had any white knuckle sobriety since I found you people. I had 11 years of white knuckle not drinking before I got here. I was losing the battle and knew it. And I wasn't going to lose to a bottle. So I became a periodic. And I was periodic for 11 years. Not sober, but I had long periods of not drinking. And there was white knuckle because it was fighting the bottle. I wasn't going to lose to a bottle. And it took it 11 years to kill me, but it did. And so, since I got here, I have not had any white knuckle sobriety. I am one who believes that surrender is victory in this thing that we have in common, not only in sobriety, but in life itself. In life itself. I think we win by giving up the fight. And everything in my book, now maybe not yours, but in mine, is surrender. Get out of your own way. And I've been trying to talk about that for 37 years. And it's the most difficult thing to talk about there is. Because the more learned you are, the more totally you know that surrenders for the weak. The strong man wins, the weak man surrenders. They seem to think that it is not normal not to want something. That you're supposed to want something. Well, I wanted a lot. And I beat my brains out to get a lot. And I ended up with nothing. And from the moment that I said to myself, if I ever live to get out of this bed, I'll find AA, until now, I've never tried to get anything. I haven't tried to get anything at all. And that's what I want to talk to you a little about. Because everything that I'd beaten my brains out to get for 43 years and ended up without has come into my life in the last 37 years. Now, the first thing I did was to fire me. I said to me, look, Dad, we have listened to your counsel for 43 years. And here we are at 43, a failure as a husband, father, businessman, man, and drunk. And that's all the departments I had. And I says, dear counsel, it's not worth a damn. So we're not listening to you anymore. You're fired. And I'm going to headquarters. Now, I had had the experience of attempting to get saved at 13. Half my family was Hardshell Baptist, and half of it was Methodist Church South. And they believed that we got here struck out. You didn't have to get saved to go to heaven. You had to get saved to keep from going to hell. Because you were already struck out. I got scared badly enough that at 13 I tried to get saved. And we had a revival. And I answered the altar call. And I went down there and prayed like hell. And nothing happened. And the preacher joined me, and we both prayed like hell. And nothing happened. And every once in a while he'd say to me, how you doing? I said, no good. So we'd start over. And he got tired again. How you doing? Not good. So we start over again. Finally, he's worn out. And he says, well, when you're baptized, it'll happen. And when the ice went out, I went in. And the old boy ducked me. And he brought me up, and he says, how you doing? I said, no good. I said, I'm all wet. But nothing's happened. Well, he said, when you're formally taken into the church, it'll happen. And I was, and it didn't. And for the next 30 years, from 13 to 43, I became an expert in religion and philosophy. I had to find out why after I'd done everything that they told me to do, then nothing had happened. And at 43, I gave up. I never found out. I even gave up on God. I figured that he'd had plenty of time. And nothing had happened. And so, I started trying to find you people. After reading the article, you know, and not even thinking about it for 5 years. I thought, well, you people knew how not to drink right now. Now, I didn't want to come to you and get what you had, because I didn't know what you had, really. And I didn't think I had any further right to try to talk God out of anything. So, I gave up. And started trying to find you. Well, I knew that you wouldn't be in the phone book because you were anonymous, weren't you? So knowing you weren't there, I never looked. That's the story of my life. I knew so damn much that wasn't true, I couldn't learn anything that was. So, I started calling people and asking them if they knew anybody, in AA. And I got a hold of a doctor who had saved my life a few times in Beverly. And I asked him if he knew anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he gave me a name and a telephone number. And it was a motion picture actor. And I called him up, and we talked a little while, and he said, have you had a drink today? And I said, no. Well, he says, don't take one. He says, I'm working nights right now, and I can't take you to meeting. But call me tomorrow. I might not be working tomorrow night, and we'll go to a meeting together. So I called him tomorrow. We talked a little while, and he says, you had a drink today? I said, no. He says, don't take one, I'm still working. Call me tomorrow. So the third day I called him, and I hadn't had a drink. And we hadn't talked but a minute. And I says, I know you're still working. He says, yeah. I says, you don't have to take me to meeting. Where's the meeting I can go to? And he told me. And it was within 10 minutes of my house in Beverly Hills. And I decided to go. Felt pretty good about it until 10 minutes before time to leave. And then I started to think. And that's one thing I want to tell you. Quit thinking! That's why we're here. So my keen alcoholic mind said to me, look, you've lived in Beverly Hills a long time, and it might not be good for your reputation to be seen with a bunch of drunks. So I finally settled that by deciding to disguise myself so I wouldn't be immediately recognizable. And then I went to the meeting. And it was in the Veterans of Foreign Wars Hall. Great big hall. Door right in the middle of the back wall. And I walked up to that door. And I looked in, and there might have been 35 people up around the front of that meeting. Not more than 35. Remember, this was prior to 37 years ago. And there weren't many people in the West Coast in Alcoholics Anonymous at that time. had been 10 years back east, but only 5 years on the coast. And so I looked in and I see these 35 people up around the front, and I could hear them talking, but I couldn't hear any words. But it was happy talk. And I said to myself, they've given me the wrong information. These aren't alcoholics. They're men and women that have no alcoholic problem at all. Because, you see, if you were alcoholic, you'd have been crying. You wouldn't have been talking happy talk. And I said, I'm going to have to leave and come back tonight. The drunks are here. And I turned to leave. And in my opinion, the next minute is the very essence of our program. Somebody in the middle of that little group had been watching me. And when I started to leave, he came running over to the door. And he called at me and he says, Mister, were you looking for somebody? And I said, no, sir. Well, he says, what were you looking for then? I said, it wouldn't interest you, sir. I was looking for sobriety. And everything about that man changed just like that. He just lit up like a Christmas tree. And it was obvious to me that he was glad I was there. Now, everybody that knew me was glad I was there, too, but for a different reason. If I was there, I couldn't be there, you see. But I knew that he was delighted that I was there because he lit up. And when he spoke again, he says, why, take off your hat and coat. You're in the right place. And he'd taken away my disguise right there, you see. He'd undressed me right there. And he took me in. And three or four of them took me in the back room and talked with me. And it was amazing to me. It was amazing. They told me what was wrong with me. Told me what was wrong with them and what they were doing to make it unnecessary to do that anymore. And so I knew they were drunks because they were marked up like I was. They had headlights here. Bags under the bags. You know. And their wiring was all exposed. Just like mine. So I knew they were drunks. But they weren't drunk. And I was comfortable. And I went back. I knew I couldn't have what you had because I didn't have enough left. And I didn't have enough time left. I was going to die. But it was comfortable there, and I went back. 37 years ago. And I'm still going back. And I'm still comfortable. So it's not difficult for me to see what makes this thing tick. What makes this thing tick? It's a little four-letter word. It's spelled L-O-V-E, love. I have come to believe in the last 37 years that the only motivation for any act whatsoever that's worth its salt is L-O-V-E, love. Now I'm going to say a few things that really I maybe shouldn't say because they're not very orthodox. Presently, I do not believe in a God of judgment. of punishment and reward. Now, I know a great deal about the religions and philosophies of the world. Know it as a drunken deacon for years. You know. I could go into a bistro. That's a good word, isn't it? I never used that. And I could talk to those drunks, you know. And I'd get them just ready to give up. And I'd fall off the bar stool. And you lose your credibility when you fall off the bar stool. And can't get back up on it. So, I've come to believe that there's no such thing as a God of judgment. I think there's a God of love and a great law of justice without judgment. I don't think there's anything in this life that says I can't do anything up to and including murder as long as I am willing to take the inevitable consequence of my thought and act. I can't believe that God could be God and be a judge. Because in order for you and I to judge, we have to run into a situation that don't fit with us. That don't fit with our ideas. And we judge. So if God could judge, it'd have to be something that he is not. And I don't believe there is anything that he is not. I think that there's a God of love and a great law that says we reap what we sow. Now, I can go right down the middle of the road with that. If I pour in slop, I don't cry because I get back slop. I change what I'm pouring in. And my life changes. I think that many of us are really doing ourselves and our society an injustice by stating that we're supposed to let go and let God. Because in my way of thinking, God hasn't anything at all to give me. Nothing. Not because he hasn't got anything, but because he already did. I think the gift of God was made at the foundations of the earth. It's always been mine. And God's always known it. But I was conditioned to believe that I had to earn it, be worthy of it. Merit, God's grace. Now I was 60 years old before I ever looked in the dictionary for the meaning of the word grace. I thought I was born knowing. And I finally looked in the dictionary and it says a free gift. How the hell are you going to earn a free gift? So I think that the life that's mine today is the life that I should have been living all the time. But you see, I was conditioned to believe I had to earn merit, be worthy of God's grace. You can't earn a free gift. If it's free, it's free. And I remember the little story of creation. You know, God, in the beginning, God. God created the heavens and the earth. He put the water down yonder and threw a fish in it. Put a mountain over here and put a tree on the mountain and a bird in the tree and a monkey under it. And he looked the situation over. He says, this is good. This is good. Now I'm going to create man in my own image and after my own likeness. Which is free. God's free. And he created us free. Just free as he is. And it's within my power, and I have the permission to do anything I want to do as long as I'm willing to pay the inevitable consequence of my thought and act. Now, I haven't had to drink for 37 years because I'm no longer willing to pay the price. I'm no longer willing to pay the price. So, indeed, life has been something different in the last 37 years. As I said a moment ago, everything that I beat my brains out to bring about and ended up without has come into my life. Everything. The biggest one, of course, is I haven't had to take a drink or a pill. But on top of that, I got rich. And I wasn't trying to. I've been trying to go someplace all my life. And I couldn't get to Watts. My plant was in the curfew zone. And I couldn't get there. And in these last 37 years, I've been all over the world. It's been my privilege to meet people like you. Practically all over this world. It's been a fascinating experience. And since I quit running my life, and my wife's life, and the kids' life, we've become a family. And it's been so easy. This has been the only easy life I've ever known. The only good life that's ever been mine. And I have to get a little bit concerned when I hear our people talking about how difficult it is to operate within the precepts of our program. The only good life I have ever known, the only easy life that's ever been mine. And I highly recommend it. Highly recommend it. The little things that I have known intellectually for a lifetime have become very meaningful to me in the last 15 years. I got out of the business world 15 years ago, and I've had a lot of time to look around me. And been a lot of things that have come to make a lot of sense to me. That I knew intellectually a long time ago, and I am of the opinion today that intellectual knowledge, the more intellectual knowledge you have, and the less you do about it, the more you have to suffer. And I don't think God puts that on us at all. I think it's us. Because, for instance, I told you in the first 43 years of my life, I never made a mistake. And now, I have had a little different action pattern for the last 37 years. I get up on the wrong side of the bed or something. And I'm in left field. And I don't raise hell with God for running off from me. I say to me, Wait a minute, big boy. What have you allowed to get important enough to get between you and your program and your God? And whatever it is has to go. And there are lots of times I don't want to go. Because it's a 95-pound blonde. But it has to go. Because I can't stand in the left field. I spent 43 years in left field. And I don't like it. So I have to see what it is. And get rid of it myself. Now, if I can, it won't make any difference. Because I share everything in my life with my very own God. Everything. The good, the bad, and the indifferent. And so I say to the Papa Man, I say, look, I'm uncomfortable as hell. And I don't know why, but you do. So I'm giving it to you. Fix it, will you? Thank you. And I go about my business. And everything's all right, you know. So, there's no place to point the finger now. I have to come to me. And get the thing right with my very own God. And I like it. I like it very much. I'm not afraid anymore. I'm not afraid. Here I am. You see him pushing me around here in a wheelchair. I have a little difficulty breathing. And I'm not too concerned about that. Because I smoked like I drank. 4 packages of Camels a day. You know? So, you do that and you're liable to have a little something wrong with your lungs. And they tell me that there's no reversing lung damage. But I tell you something, I'm a lot better than I was 4 years ago. A lot better. So I'm not concerned about that. And furthermore, I'm not concerned about an exit from this particular room of life. I'm not concerned about leaving you. I don't want to go. I mean, I'm in no hurry. You know? But I'm not concerned about it. There's a little verse in the other book, the other big book. It's attributed to the carpenter man, where he says, who by taking thought can add 1 cubit to his stature? Now to me that means this, that you and I cannot change the reality of our own being. We can only change our experience in reality. You hear me? We can't change the reality of our own being. If one of us is God's kid, all of us are. If one of us is not one of us is. In my way of thinking. And I think old Tojo and Hitler and Capone and all the rest of them, one of these days has to come back home to the living God that made us. Because God is life. And we're alive. I remember in 1955, the second international conference in AA was held in Kiel Auditorium in St. Louis. And I was there. And on Sunday morning, Dr. Shoemaker and second international conference in AA was held in Kiel Auditorium in St. Louis. And I was there. And on Sunday morning, Dr. Shoemaker and Father say it again.
Ed Dolly.
Ed Dolly. Were the speakers at the meeting on Sunday morning. And I got acquainted with the two of them, but mainly with Father Ed Dolly. Because the little punk had forgotten his teeth. And here he was up there before the biggest audience he'd ever had, trying to hold a towel over his face so we wouldn't know he didn't have any teeth. And I fell in love with him. And he lived another 5 years, and we spent a lot of time together. And he told, I don't happen to be Catholic, but I'm not opposed to him. But anyway, Father Ed said to me, Chuck, he said, your cross was alcoholism. He says, my cross was lack of faith. He says, I went to school 18 years and was ordained a Jesuit priest. And I never believed anything. And then he said something that I couldn't repeat for a lot of years without bawling. He says, I came to believe, watching what happens to you people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he wasn't even an alcoholic. The last time we were together, it was just before he died, and he was in St. Louis again. And I talked, and he said a little prayer for us. And after the meeting, Mrs. C and I were going to get some coffee. And she says, Chuck, maybe Father Ed'd like you with us. I said, maybe he would. Why don't you ask him? I wasn't going to ask him. I'm a sensitive alcoholic. I didn't want to ask him and have him tell me no. So she asked him, and he went with us. And he sat there and questioned me for probably an hour and a half. And every once in a while I'd say, Father, you talk. I'd love to hear you talk. So he'd ask another question. And finally he said to me, Chuck, tell me about the family. Tell me about your family. I said, no. Miss C's sitting here. Let her tell you about the family. And she told him. And he sat there looking off out the window for seemingly forever. And then he came back to me and he says, do you know something, Chuck? And I said, what, Father? He says, sometimes I have to believe that heaven is just a new pair of glasses. And I said to my wife, what's the difference? You see, I sit in the same chair that I sat in for 15 years in hell. And now, 37 years in heaven. And that's a sermon as long as from here to Mars and back. Says heaven was always in that chair. I was in hell. Hear me? So, sometimes I have to believe that heaven is just a new pair of glasses, you know? Now, I was never able to bring about the experience in my own life of feeling that in him we live and move and have our being, you know. And I couldn't understand why, because I knew intellectually an awful lot about that stuff. And I knew that the fault must be with me. The fault must be with me. But I couldn't make this thing personally mine until I got to playing with a few of the facts that I knew about the life around us that isn't human. For instance, I've known for years that a salmon born at the headwaters of the Klamath River, when it gets so big, it goes downstream. And it's liable to go from my country clear to Japan and back before it goes back up the headwaters of the Klamath River and spawns and dies. And I got to saying to myself, who's his travel agent? Because I get lost on the freeway with a sign every 90 feet, you know. Here's a damn salmon that goes clear to Japan and back. You know? Who's his travel agent? And so I had to swim with him, and when I got back, I knew. God's idea of a salmon includes everything necessary for its complete fulfillment, including going to Japan and back. We got a little phenomenon down there. Bunch of swallows. They show up at the mission at San Juan Capistrano every St. Joseph's Day, almost on the minute. And they winter in Venezuela. Who's their travel agent? You know. And so we have to believe that God's idea of a swallow includes everything necessary for its complete fulfillment. A number of years ago, I was up east of Santa Cruz. There's a fenced-in place up there that has a few very real interesting things in it. One of them is the sister trees. These trees drew across each other. And when the wind blew, they annoyed each other. So what did they do? They grew a natural grass between them. And it holds them apart. Got rid of the annoyance. Now, I can go along pretty good with the idea of the salmon and the swallow because they move around. But here's a couple of sticks of wood that grow a natural grass to get comfortable. And I stood up in the rain looking at you, bawling like a baby. In that same complex, there's a great big redwood tree. And a couple of hundred years ago, the base of that tree burned out. And I stood there in that rain, and I looked at what happened. That tree grew limbs down and in that burn. And you can stand right there and look at it. And you know damn well that that ain't the way limbs grow. They go out and up. But these grew out and down and then that burnt. And I'm standing up there bawling. Because I'm an Indian. And I know trees don't grow that way, you know. But there they were. So God's idea of a redwood tree includes everything necessary for its complete fulfillment too. And I had to say to myself, then, why is it so difficult for me to abandon myself to life? To quit trying to improve on God's handiwork and to live in and be in and have my being in Him? Because I said to me, would God give something to a redwood tree or to a salmon or to a swallow that He wouldn't give to His kids? And I'd say no. No, my job is to go about my Father's business And it's his job to take care of me. And that's all I've done for 37 years. And as I told you a minute ago, I never had it so good. The only easy life I've ever known, the only good life that's ever been mine. And I believe that that's our job, to share our experience, strength, and hope one with another in love, and let the chips fall where they may. I think that's it, the whole deal. And when we do that, we discover that underneath are the everlasting arms. Personally, I must tell you that I know an awful lot about religion and philosophy, but I have never in 80 years seen anything that I would trade our program for. We have the formula for the best life that there is. And it's nothing in the world but helping God's kids do things that they need to have done because we want to. No price tag at all. And I'll close with this little story. I was allowed to buy the business that I'd been in for many years. Some 15 years before I got out of business. And I had the most remarkable business experience after I had acquired the business itself, because I'd never worked for anybody in that business that would saw one stick of wood without a signed contract and a check, you know. Because a little deal with me was $25,000, a big one was $250,000. And I never had a signature in the whole 15 years I owned that business. And I never had anybody ask me to write down anything. And I'll give you a little example. We have a meeting down home in West Vena. It's a big meeting. It's in a church. And it's been 25 years. 24 years, matter of fact, that group has been going. And a certain maverick by the name of Clancy I from up in the sky he's talked at that meeting the Saturday before Christmas every year. And I've talked at the anniversary. Incidentally, he called me his sponsor. I never sponsored anybody. When he asked me to be his sponsor, he had just given me two tickets for a World Series game where Koufax was pitching. And then he asked me to be his sponsor. Hell, I wasn't going to give him back the tickets. So I told him, I said, well, I never sponsor anybody, but I'll give you anything you've got for free. And so we've had a pretty good relationship. And I knew 24 years ago that it was impossible for him ever to get sober. He was not right. And today, Clancy has the biggest group in the world in Alcoholics Anonymous. Weekly group. And he's a tremendous guy. He's a big man. And so, he asked me to be his sponsor, and I have shared with him ever since. But I guess he's probably taught me a great deal more than I have him. Because I started the way ahead of him. I was just a drunk. You know, I wasn't a tramp. He had no front teeth when I met him. He was dirty. He stank. He lived in the back end of an abandoned car in the old 6300 Club lot. Our parking lot, and there wasn't a chance. And here he is with the biggest weekly meeting in the world, doing a whale of a job. So he talks out there on the Saturday before Christmas. I talked to anniversary, and a year ago or so I was out there waiting for him to call the meeting to order. And I look down and in the center aisle, here comes a guy that I've done hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of business with. And he's not an alcoholic. And I said to myself, what's old Bob doing here? And I went down and met him and hugged him a little and told him how glad I was to see him. And I said, what are you doing here, Bob? Because he wasn't an alcoholic. And he says, Chuck, I was visiting so-and-so, who is a friend of mine, friend of his, this afternoon. And I said to him, what are you doing tonight? And he said, you damn fool, you know what I'm doing. It's Saturday night. I'm going to my meeting at West Covina. And Bob says, you know who you're going to listen to? And he says, yeah. He says, I'm going to listen to old Chuck C. He talks here on every anniversary, and this is our anniversary. And I says, can I go with you? And here he was. And I introduced him to the three or four guys that I was sitting with. And Bob stood there looking at the floor. And he says, I want to tell you, gentlemen, something about this guy. He says, the only man I ever did business with in my life that I never asked to write down anything. And then he quit talking. It was rather awkward. And I had to say, that's true, Bob. But it's also true that I've never asked you to write down anything either, isn't it? He said, yes. Now, why do I tell you that story? Because I am totally convinced from my toenails to the top of my longest hair that it's my business to go about God's business, which is to help his kids do things they need to have done, because I want to, for free and for fun. And it's his business to take care of me. That's his business. That is not my business. And I, again, I'm here for two reasons. First, to tell you I love you. And second, to tell you to quit thinking. You know? And to do what has been my life for 37 years. And that's to go about my father's business to the best of my ability. Because I want to. Just because I want to. And watch what happens. And it's been the most interesting thing. And I have loved this weekend with you people. This has been, to me, an Alcoholics Anonymous affair. This has been right. I've been listening to your panels in there, and they've been good. And they've been on the beam. And again and again and again. I am positive that we, the drunks of the world, have got a thing going that might be the greatest thing that's happening in the world today. Because our formula for life and living and for sharing and caring is, to me, the very essence of the life of the carpenter. Fear not, a little flock. It's the Father's good pleasure to give us the kingdom. To give it to us. But not on our terms. On His. And that is that we share our experience, strength, and hope one with another in love. Which is Alcoholics Anonymous. And again, I love it to pieces. And I love you very, very much. And I haven't been to enough meetings. I'm going to keep coming back here until you pat me in the face with a scoop. God bless you. Thank you very much.